This is a podcast from the BBC. For more information and terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/podcasts.
Mr. Lane, could I ask you about your officers? Were they much in evidence at this stage? Because you hadn't mentioned them very
well. Well, I want to mention the officers. At that time, our officers were practically all ex-public schoolboys. And we had great respect for them. I think the officers regarded the men as quite a separate sort of human being, really. Well, I mean, it's obvious. You've got to have that, you see, because to get discipline.
In the British Army during the First World War, just as in civilian life, your rank defined your days and your nights, what you ate, where you slept, what you wore, and even how you might die.
When there was a chance of any comfort, they had it, you know, in every way that they could, either in food or lodgings or anything else. They always had the best.
They were put up, they had baths and God knows what. They had everything laid on for them. We regarded that as only natural.
You had to recognise who they were. They were officers, you had to recognise that. But apart from that, off parade, they'd come to see that you was all right, wherever you were.
At the beginning of the war, class, education and money brought you an officer's commission, and with it, better conditions. The structure of the army mirrored Britain's social order, and the soldiers of 1914 were accustomed to everyone having their place. But contrary to many of the myths of the war, the officers were, in turn, told to make the welfare of their men their highest priority. Although you can hear resentment in the voices of some of the veterans, many officers earned the respect of their men, despite their better pay and conditions. That respect was forged in the most dire circumstances.
Did you have much time for officers overall?
Well, like I say, not a lot. But I did like this sharpener. The last, very last one I had. He was the best through the whole war. He was a gentleman in every way, even in wartime at the front. He was a gentleman.
A story often told about the war in books, TV and films is one of generals situated well behind the lines in chateau, completely removed from the reality of the trenches. Lions led by donkeys is what we've been told. But the memories of some of the survivors of the war cast a different, more nuanced light. The army was, and still is, governed by a strict rank structure. The hierarchy was very much maintained, from a general down through the ranks to private. Joseph Napier and John Malilieu recalled life in the officers' mess.
There wasn't all that close connection, I must admit. It's something which I often wonder about. Though I got on, and we all got on well, same way as the officers, the senior officers, didn't talk much to the junior officers very much, there wasn't that sort of close affinity or comradeship between the officers and their men. Though we had duty patrols to go and look through the men's quarters and see they were all right, I don't think I was particularly pally with anybody, either by instinct or inclination or otherwise.
The senior officers ran the mess, and you couldn't smoke before you were given permission and that sort of thing. Senior ranks at the top table who got served first, which we groused about, and otherwise it was quite pleasant.
Did you have a servant?
Yes. All officers had a batman. They woke you in the morning if you were in somewhere and brought you a cup of tea, cleaned up your equipment.
Do you think your servant made a big difference to the comfort of your life?
There's no doubt about it. The officers were really very lucky. I have thought often since conditions of the officers were very much better than the conditions of the men.
Jim Davis was an officer in the Royal Fusiliers from 1917 onwards.
First of all, they gave me a servant, Turner, old sweat, reservist, who was very, very good. Took great pride in polishing my Sam Brown dinner. He always came in and brushed me down, polished my boots, my shoes and everything. Oh no, they were very good blokes, the officers' servants.
just keep his equipment clean and that, and find him his shaving water, his washing water and all this, that and other. And that was it. And then he'd be set up for a day.
How did you get on with your officer? What was his name?
Lieutenant Clark.
And how did you get on with him?
Oh, he was a very nice man.
Peter Hart of the Imperial War Museums interviewing Jack Heppelston, who was an officer's servant for a year. Officers had to give orders that would lead to the death of the men under their command. Those orders had to be obeyed for the war to be won. Intimacy might weaken the determination of the officer to issue the orders, or of the soldiers to obey them. As for the generals in their chateau, there wasn't much point in them being up in the trenches. They needed space for their planning staff, their maps, and telephone exchanges to talk to neighbouring units and artillery. It meant they were distant, but they were more effective. Of course, there were those who were only too happy to keep their distance from the lower ranks.
We walked all night up through the trenches, crawling, you see, ready to go over at daybreak. And I remember we got into a side trench, and there were two officers, the adjutant and his nephew, who disdainfully helped us out of the trenches.
You say these officers looked disdainfully at you?
Well, they had to touch us, you see, to help us out. A couple of snobs there were.
Do you remember their names?
Yes.
Early on in the war, in 1914-15, most officers had a public school background. He wasn't one of them. He was a proper officer, a gentleman, you know, and they sort of became fond of them.
Peter Hart of the Imperial War Museums noticed recurring themes in what the men said about their officers.
There was this bond, a very real affection in many cases. It's not that they were their friend or that they'd be able to have any social contact with them, but they appeared to be proper gentlemen in the way they behaved. But then again, some of them kicked against the privileges of rank and the rest of it. But there was this relationship, this bond, this affection. And after all, these men would take them over the top in action eventually.
Our own company officer was named Snowden. I remember that quite well. His name was Snowden. He was a very serious man. His father was a vicar. Very conscientious.
Lynn Smith interviewed Clifford Lane for the Imperial War Museums in 1983.
This was only for the first year or so, because after that, well, the least said the better.
I was wondering about this communication. You know, you had a jam tin with a message flung into your trench.
Yeah.
Wouldn't the officers have come round with messages and...
No. This jam tin was thrown into our trench and was thrown back and back and back. It would be received by an officer eventually, you see. No, we didn't. We hardly saw an officer, really. You've got to remember that the difference between officers and other ranks in the regular army and in the territorials was much greater than it is now. An officer in the regular army, to be in some regiments, he'd have to have at least 500 or 600 a year. To be in the guard, he'd have to have 1,000 a year at least. An officer in the regular army would never speak to a private, and in fact you couldn't approach an officer without an NCO, non-commissioned officer, taking you to see an officer, you see. So that I'm not saying that they weren't concerned with the welfare of their men, but they were regarded as a different species.
There's a range of what people say about their officers that goes from that they were unfeeling swine to that they were complete gentlemen who would do anything for them. You know, when you've got millions of men, you've got millions of different characters. So many officers were good officers and they would make their daily inspection. They'd check for their men. Other officers wouldn't. They would send someone else to do it, a sergeant, or they'd just neglect it.
It was a more hierarchical, more deferential age. But there was some bitterness at a system of recruitment which often meant young, inexperienced ex-public schoolboys were in charge of seasoned fighters. Non-commissioned officers, or NCOs, like sergeants, often earned more respect than the officers themselves.
An NCO, a good NCO, is the backbone of any regiment. They've been through the ranks. They also know more about life than the officer did, who's probably been brought up with a silver spoon. And you've more trust in the sergeant with you than probably the officer above you, because you see more of him and you're with him more, and you trust them more.
There was another reason why officers didn't often build up a strong relationship with their men. By 1917, war had taken its toll at all levels of society, but particularly on the officer class.
You see, officers didn't last very long.
Was that noticeably that they didn't last very
long? Yes, they seemed to come and go. We seemed to have heavier casualties amongst officers than any other.
Well, they've got to make them up from somewhere. They ran out of all the public school boys and blokes from the universities who had done a bit of OTC training. And they were coming down to the best territorial battalions.
Did the men know you were a ranker officer, someone who'd come up from the ranks?
Oh, I expected they would know that anyway.
Did they treat you differently from the other officers?
No. Most of the blokes by 1917... had served in the ranks.
The most dangerous job in the British Army was being a junior officer. They would lead the men over the top and were expected to set the example. In fact, it was said that the NCOs taught the men how to fight, the officers taught them how to die.
Later on, no. Anybody could do that twice times table could have become an officer, really. Oh, no, they were hopeless.
Most of all, experienced NCOs were starting to come through. And these were ordinary working-class people, in many cases, or lower middle class. And some men didn't like that, because those people, especially former NCOs, would know all the tricks of the trade. They'd been private soldiers themselves. They knew when they were up to no good. It's also snobbishness, because this ex-sergeant isn't a proper officer, he's one of them. And this is, it's quite a strange thing. It is something that you do get coming across through the interviews.
Through our 21st century eyes, it's hard to look at the events of the First World War and the structure of the army without wondering how discipline among British soldiers was broadly maintained throughout. 1917 was the year when revolution and mutiny loomed elsewhere. But for Clifford Lane, the memory of having to help a ranker officer out during the shelling at Saint Jean and his lack of a stiff upper lip lingered well after the war.
I said, "What the bloody hell are we hanging about here for? We shall all get slaughtered." And he looked up at me and said, "Do you think we ought to get out, Corporal?" I said, "Yes, sir." I said, "You lead them out and I'll see the last man is following, you see." And we got them all across the road, onto the overland route, and then nobody was hurt at all. I was sitting on the fire step one night, and this officer came and sat down beside me. And he said, "You were very good the other night, Corporal Lane." And he said, "I expect the men think I'm a windy bugger, don't they?" I said, "Well, I don't know." So I said, "We're all windy, of course, you know, that sort of thing." I mean, you can't imagine one of our old ex-public school boys saying that. To come to me on that trench and saying, "I expect the men think I'm a windy bugger," I came to the conclusion that the officer material was getting very, very poor.
Had most of them been killed by then?
Well, yes, they'd been killed or wounded. Of course, they got many privileges. They got much more leave than we did, you know. They wouldn't go take them out and say, "Look, you've got to pull your socks up," and that sort of thing. They'd send them home on leave because they were mostly well-connected people, you see.